We're doing the page that we did 2 weeks ago, but a continuation. I hope those who attended Rabbi Bienenfeld's share last week enjoyed and got much out of it. We've moved on to Sefer Shemot. We've given an introduction using the Ramban's introduction to Sefer Shemot. And the Ramban, in source number 2, made a claim that the theme of the book of Sefer Shemot was from Galut to Geula, from exile to redemption. You know that the English name of the book is called Exodus, but we know that was a name of a movie. From redemption, from exile. And because from exile, Ramban feels that there was a need to take a few steps in reverse and go back to Parshat Vayigash, the tail end of Sefer Breshit, and pick up from Ve'el Shmot B'nei Yisrael Haba'im Mitzrayimah. The Ramban says that the very first pasuk of Sefer Shmot is nothing but a quote from that pasuk in Parshat Vayigash, where it says that Yaakov and his children came down to Mitzrayim. So if you want to put your finger on where exactly does the galut, the exile, begin, it begins with the entry of Yaakov and his family to Mitzrayim. And there the Torah says, and here are the names. So we get a complete listing of 66 names, and you have Yosef and his children. So it adds up to 70. It really adds up to 69, but you know, don't bother me with the facts. The Abarbanel says the Torah rounds out numbers. And even though we grew up on Rashi in the Medrash, that the 70th was Yocheved, who was born Bein HaChomot, and as they were coming in, that reminds me of all my friends from Borough Park. Nobody was born in Hungary. Nobody admitted they were born in Hungary. Everybody was born on the border between Hungary. That was the largest maternity ward in Europe, the border between Romania and Hungary, right? Okay, probably they were born on the border. So Yocheved was born on the border, Bein HaChomot, and she was the 7th, going to the Medrash. But Barbanel is not disturbed by the fact that the grand total is 69, but the Torah says Shivim, because there are other examples where the number adds up to 9, and the Torah rounds it out to the 10th, like in Sfirat HaOmer, Shiva Shavuot Tispor Lach, counts 7 weeks. Every child should know that 7 times 7 is 49, yet the Torah says Tisporu Chamishim Yom. We never count the 50th. With regard to giving malkot, we know that the maximum malkot is 39, yet the Torah has no problem saying Arba'im Yakenu Lo Yosef, you give 40, but nobody ever got 40. So this is something which is the style of the Torah. And if you don't believe me, what is the statistical probability that after doing a census, a count of population, for 12 individual Shvatim, that each of them, every single one, is going to come out a nice round number to the 100, one of them to the 50, but all of the others to 100. What is the statistical probability that's going to happen? Even if it happens on 1 out of 12, that's a tremendous thing. Well, that's a fluke, if you want. But to happen 12 times in a row... So I remember my Ivrit became more polished and advanced when I was already teaching in Beersheba. And there you, of course, learned the slang of the land. So there's a Hebrew slang word, a word that's used in slang. It's called fuchs. Fuchs means it's just a highly unusual. It's the weirdest thing in the world that happens. Fuchs. So I heard kids were using the word, and I would ask them, without any embarrassment, what does fuchs mean? So a kid tells me, fuchs is that if you have the basketball and your back is towards the basket and you throw it this way and you hit it into the solid, into the basket, that's a fuchs. And if you do it 10 times in a row, you're a fuchsionaire. That's fuchsionaire. So they taught me Hebrew. Fuchsionaire. Fine. So this would be a fuchsionaire. 12 shvatim. Everybody coming out to a zero at the end. That's really, really weird. But it's obviously clear that the numbers are not exact, but they're rounded out. Which proves that the Rabban Shalom was not a Yekka, because in Frankfurt they would never tolerate this kind of inconsistencies. Once the Torah does say, with regard to how many of the people were killed in the aftermath of the golden calf, the Egel Azav, it says Kish Loshet Alafim, around 3,000. Why did the Torah say 3,000? There, the Torah decided to use the 3,000. Not to tell us that it was 2,951 and a half, because the Torah, it rounds out. But somehow there was a reason that the Torah felt that here, let's just give an impression that it's not exact. It says, Ki Shloshet Alafim Ish. But you see, even in that context, it was important to round out. So that's why it says Shivim. In Parshat Shmot, The Torah does not have to go through the 20 psukim of listing all the 66 names again, but it simply starts with the headline, Ve'elishmot b'nei Yisrael abei Mitzrayim, and then gives the just the headlines, Ruven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, this is the 12th, Vayu kol nefesh, everybody adds up to Shivim. So in a very, very compact way, we have those 20 psukim of Parshat Vayigash, and then Torah picks up, Vayakol melech hadash ha-Mitzrayim, ha-shalo yadat Yosef, and the story continues. So Ramban says the story of Sefer Shmot is from beginning to the end, from the beginning of the Galut to when Yaakov and Banav came to Mitzrayim, and the end of Galut. So when is end of Galut? So let's go back to source number two. In source number two, right after, by the underline, the third line where it's underlined, meaning Yachay Sefer Ve'ele Shmot Binyana Galut HaRishon HaNigzar B'Farshat B'Farashah B'Ferush rather U'B'Gula Mimeno. The book is dedicated to the theme of the first exile and the redemption from it. L'chein chazar v'tchil b'shemot yodei Mitzrayim u'misparam. That's why the Torah repeats the names of the children of Yaakov and the final number, 70. Aval pi shekvar nichtav zeh, even though we know of this already from Sefer Bereshit, Parshat Vayigash, bavur ki yiridatam sham, because the very, very going down to Mitzrayim, hu reshit hagalut ki me'az huchal. That's precisely when the exile begins. V'nei galut einena nishlam, the galut, the exile is not complete, ad yom shuvam el mikomam, until the time that they return to their place, vel ma'alat avotam yashuvu, to they restore to the plateau, the level of the forefathers. And the question is, when does that exactly happen? U'kishyetzu mimitzrayim, when they went out of Egypt, Ava pishi yatsumi beit avadim, even though they were redeemed, they went out of slavery. Adayim yechashvu golim, they were still considered exiles. Why? Ki hayu ba'aretz lo lahem, they were still in the land that was not theirs. They were in the desert. Nivuchim ba'midbar. That was a phrase used in the parsha that we just read on Shabbat. Parshat Bishalach. In Yiddish, it's called fablonjet. It means they were lost in the desert. וכשבאו על הר סיני ועשו המשכן ושב הקדוש ברוך הוא וישרה שכינתו ביניהם. And when they approached Har Sinai, and immediately after Har Sinai, the giving of the Torah, what comes next on the agenda? Parshiot Truma Tetzaveh Kitisa Vayakel Pekudei, the last half, the second half of Sefer Shmot, the construction, the tzivui, the mitzvah of construction of the Mishkan, and the implementation in Parshiot Vayakel Pekudei. Then the Torah says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, Shechinato, rested there. As shavu el ma'alat avotam shehaya sod eloha elohei ale el ohalehem vehem heim amerkava. That's a Kabbalistic idea where HaKadosh Baruch Hu has returned to the level, his being here in the physical world, the level that existed in the days of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, ve'az nechshavu geulim, and then they were considered redeemed. L'chein nishlam ha-sefer hazeh, the book is completed, ba'shlimo inyan ha-mishkan, the Sefer Shmot ends with Parshat Pekudei, where it clearly completes the whole story and description of the construction of the Mishkan, u'biyot kvod Hashem malei otam tamir. Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence would be there forever. Well, there's one little question here, specifically coming from the Ramban. We'll see in a moment, it's the Ramban who argues that the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael is one of the 613 mitzvot. If you go to the Song of Dayenu, so it's very interesting that the poet takes us all the way from Yitzhak Mitzrayim, Ilu Atzan Mitzrayim, and it takes us to not only the entering Eretz Yisrael, but more importantly, the building of Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. And that's the review at the end. Alach Kam Chama, we go backwards. Sheotziyanu Mitzrayim, V'salam Shvatim, and so on, so on, so on, so on. V'chnisanu Eretz Yisrael, U'banalanu Beit HaBchira, L'chaper Alavonotenu. That's like the end game. And to really show that the end game of Yitzhak Mitzrayim was the construction of Beit HaMikdash, this is borne out by Sefer Melachim, Perek Vav, Pasuk Aleph, and Bet, which is the Haftarah, by the way, from, I believe, Parshat Truma, where there the Navi says, Shmonim Shana, V'arba Meot Shana, L'tzeit B'nei Yisrael Mitzrayim. And the Beit HaMikdash was constructed 480 years after the going out of Mitzrayim. Why is it important to date the construction of the first Beit HaMikdash in terms of the Yitziat Mitzrayim? Why was that important? If not to indicate that the building of the first Beit HaMikdash is really the concluding act. You may call it an epilogue, but a necessary epilogue to the Yitziat Mitzrayim. Before the building of the first Beit HaMikdash, we cannot say that we were fully redeemed. So here the Ramban comes and says that we were fully redeemed at the end of Sefer Shemot, which is the construction of the Mishkan. The Mishkan is now up and running, and this is considered already Am Yisrael being Geulim. Yet there's a few things missing here. We didn't enter into Eretz Yisrael, we didn't build the Beit HaMikdash. To this end, the Ramban has a phenomenal theory that you have Har Sinai, and that whole Har Sinai story is this week's parsha, Parshat Yitro. The Har Sinai stance, Am Yisrael at Har Sinai, takes us from this week's parsha, from Yitro, until the end of Sefer Vayikra. The entire book of Vayikra, there's no action. Nobody's moving. Everybody's still at Har Sinai. And at the very end of Parshat Bichukotai, you get the closing comment that this is all given at Har Sinai. When does Am Yisrael begin to move? In Sefer Bamidbar. Because that's exactly what Bamidbar is all about. The travels in the Midbar. And if you see in Parshat Shmo Bamidbar and Parshat Naso, so there you have the arrangement of Am Yisrael in the Midbar according to the various Shvatim, three on each side, but four sides, and all the Nesi'im. It's Chanukat HaMishkan. Parshat Naso, the bringing of the Korban of each Nasi for 12 days, is simply a continuation of Parshat Pekudei, of the opening ceremony, Vahi Biyom Hakim Et HaMishkan. Parshat Naso, does it? And then you get the Parshat Balotcha. That's when Moshe Rabbeinu invites his father-in-law Yitro, which almost closes this parsha, which is Yitro. Yitro comes into the picture here in Parshat Yitro, where he comes and he converts. Of course, we hear about him already in Parshat Shmot, where Moshe Rabbeinu meets up with the family in Midian of the family of Yitro. But in Parshat Yitro, Vayishma Yitro, Yitro heard all the news. And the Gemara says, Mashmua Shema Ba'u V'nit Gayer. What was the clinching piece of news? He heard a lot of things. But what was it that really brought him around to convert V'nit Gayer? So the Gemara gives three suggestions. One is the war of Amalek, and one is the Kriyat Yamsuf, and one is the giving of the Torah. And of course the answer was all three. all three were very, very significant. And this brought Yitro around, and he's with Klal Yisrael. And he shows up again in Parshat Balotcha. Moshe Rabbeinu turns to him and says, Nosim Anachnu, and invites him to join Am Yisrael, not to be, there's a machloket whether Yitro came along or not. So we're not going to deal with this now. But the fact is, Moshe Rabbeinu is begging him to come along, and you're our guiding light, and he has a lot of respect for his father-in-law, which is a nice thing to do. And listen, Yitro supported him for a few years, you know. But Moshe wasn't sitting in a koilel, he was tending to the sheep, to the flock of Yitro. Those, you know how many years it was? It was like 60 years. It was from age 20 until age 80. Yitro, Moshe Rabbeinu was out of the picture. And we're going to talk about that. Not today, but this is a very important part of understanding who Moshe Rabbeinu was as being out of the picture for some 60 years. And he shows up in Mitzrayim and Sefer Shemot. He's in Parshat Va'era, he's 80 years old already. He's collecting Social Security for 15 years already. So Ramban tells us a big chidush. The question is, the egel, the golden calf, according to Rashi, just to understand Ramban, we're going to posit it against Rashi. Rashi says that where you have the mitzvah, the command to construct the Mishkan in Parshat Truma and Tetzaveh, the Mishkan and the artifacts, and then the Big Day Kahuna and Parshat Tetzaveh. And then you have Parshat Kitisa, that's when the everything caves in, and they make the Egel. And then you have the implementation of the Mishkan, which is Vayakel Pekudei. Rashi says, Ein Mukdam Uchaba Torah. There's something out of sync in the chronology here of the Chumash, because the command to build the Mishkan was after the sin of the Egel Azahav, was basically a reaction to that that sin. Where HaKadosh Baruch Hu perhaps thought that Am Yisrael would be able to make it theologically without having the use of some physical intermediary between man and God, a sanctuary and Kohanim and Korbanot. But when what happened was, Moshe Rabbeinu, as if to say he was delayed because of their calculation from returning from Har Sinai, they panic and they need something physical to look at and to bow down to and to bring Korbanot to, and they make the Egel. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, all right, you know, but just do it my way. Do it my way. We'll have it. But I'm just going to tell you how to do it. So that's the way Rashi sees things, that the Mishkan is a capitulation to the realities of Am Yisrael. Ramban doesn't see it that way at all. He says the chronology of the Chumash is perfect. And Parshat Truma and Tetzaveh, the command to build the Mishkan, that's there before the sin of the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. Why? Why was the command given? Because Ramban says that Har Sinai, the mountain, remains in the Sinai desert. But the concept of Har Sinai, that which it represents, the location for the giving of the Torah, the meeting place, the rendezvous between Moshe Rabbeinu and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's going to move on with Klal Yisrael. And that concept of Matan Torah, which happens to be an ongoing process, it didn't have a beginning and an end, and now let's close up shop and that's it. Matan Torah is now behind us. The entire rationale for having an oral law, Torah Shebaal Peh, was there to include Klal Yisrael in the process of Matan Torah, which means that that process continues on some level till this very day, even though it seems that everything is pretty much shut tight with Svarim already in place, Mishnah and Gemara and Rambam and Shulchan Aruch and Poskim and so on. What's left for us to do but to study these books? And the answer is that there's still room for Navaleh, for Chidushim. Okay, hello? Did I say something wrong? Okay. As long as it didn't explode. That's all. Open one. Some. Welcome to technology. That's all. Ramban says that the concept of Har Sinai moves along with Am Yisrael through the Mishkan. So the Mishkan is Har Sinai on wheels. That's basically what it is. It's Har Sinai on wheels. It's going to move with Am Yisrael and make its final, arrive at its final station at Yerushalayim. It'll take some time. How long will it take? 480 years from Yitziat Mitzrayim. So that's how long it's going to take. Har Sinai is just 7 weeks after Yitziat Mitzrayim. So it's 480 years after Maimon Har Sinai. That's when Shlomo HaMelech finally builds the Mikdash. And from there, there's no longer movement of Har Sinai. And here the Rav suggested, and perhaps one of his most famous understandings of Har Sinai and Har HaMoriah, he said we examine the two very famous mountains of Klal Yisrael. It has nothing to do with Mount Everest or Mount McKinley. Nothing at all. He says we have Har Sinai and Har HaMoriah. So where exactly is Har HaMoriah? Everyone knows where Har HaMoriah is. You get on the number one bus or the number three bus, or you do a little walking from here, and 20 minutes later, you're there. You're in Har HaMoriah. You can go up to the rooftop of Yeshivat HaKotel or Eish HaTorah and see it. I mean, you can go to Har HaZeitim and Har HaTzofim. You can see Har HaMoriah very, very clearly. So it's visible, it's here, it's tangible. And some people walk on Har HaMoriah and go up to what's called Har HaBayit. We know exactly where it is. Where's Har Sinai? We don't have a clue. We don't have a clue. There are three different suggestions. So the archaeologists have pointed to a particular mountain, Jebel Har Musa. Musa means Moshe. Har Musa is Moshe. Jebel means a mountain. Jebel Har Musa. That's one possibility. The other is Santa Catarina, another mountain that there's even a church. And they say maybe this is Har Sinai. And then in the map there's another triangle with a question mark. It says Har Sinai. Maybe it's there. And the Rav said, isn't it strange that for 120 days, 3 40-day consecutive periods, Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence is on Har Sinai, and nobody took the pain to That said, okay, fine. No, they're not. They're working in a different, what we're doing is they're working in a different room, I think. That's all it is. Nobody took the pain to put a marker that we were here. You know that every Israeli, sometimes they leave impressions. They go on certain tours and all of a sudden they scratch their names or their class and their school name. I mean, people have done things that are very, very not nice. I mean, I've seen it even in Poland in different locations where kids have scratched into tables and on walls and decorate that we were here. I mean, there's a way to do it, but you don't have to deface property. You go to a place like Beit Guvrin in a beautiful ancient cave, I mean, the wall is completely scratched up with names of organizations and people and schools, usually schools and kids that want to put a type of matzeva, an andarta, some type of a relic of sort. Can you imagine at Har Sinai, we didn't even leave one Coca-Cola can? There's nothing for the archaeologists to dig up to find that we were there. Three American astronauts went to the moon. Actually, two landed on the moon, Neil Armstrong and his buddy, Buzz Aldrin. And they left an andarta. We were here, signed by the President of the United States, Richard Nixon. So they say, of course, that was done so that when the Russians get there, they should know who was first. Okay, said them. But they did it. They left an andarta. They left a monument of sorts. At Har Sinai, we left nothing. Why? Har Moriah, the national memory of Am Yisrael, has never forgotten where it was. And Har Sinai, blank out. You know, we blanked out. It's just not there. The Rav said as follows. There's something very fundamental about the concept of Kedusha, sanctity. The only sanctity in this world that's long-living is sanctity that's human initiated. A human being brings Kedusha into this world. That Kedusha remains forever. If a Kadosh Baruch Hu happens to pass by, so at the moment of presence of God, it's very, very holy. But then when a Kadosh Baruch Hu, as if to say, leaves the area, he takes his Kedusha with him, and nothing actually remains. Nothing remains. Because a Kadosh Baruch Hu initiated the Kedusha on Har Sinai, and not human beings. He came to the Sneh, the burning bush, to Moshe Rabbeinu, and then comes down to Am Yisrael at Har Sinai, and then leaves. So there's really nothing left of the Kedusha, and anybody who may even accurately identify a particular mountain in the Sinai Peninsula as being Har Sinai, you don't have to go to the mikveh, you don't have to do any particular religious preparation, you can just go up to, it's chulin, it's just like going to any other place in the world for that matter. No sanctity whatsoever. Yet, Har Habayit is where Avram Avinu answered the call, Hineini. So that was a Kiddush Hashem, that he's willing to do it. And that became the place that a Kadosh Baruch Hu will choose. Makom Hashem Yivchar Hashem. So if a Kadosh Baruch Hu will choose it, so it seems that it's divine. And if it's divine, why should the Shekhinah, why should the Kedusha remain permanently? So there are two answers. One is, because a Kadosh Baruch Hu decided never to leave it. Never to leave it. Just like in Har Sinai, he decided to leave, so the Kedusha is left. In Har Habayit, Kadosh Baruch Hu decided never to leave it. And by the way, what I said now is not an agadic idea, but it's a halacha. It's a halacha. The Rambam says it in Perek Zayin, 7th chapter of Hilchot Beit HaBchira, that the mitzvah, mikidashi tira'u, not to fear, but to have awe, A-W-E, awe of Beit HaMikdash, that mitzvah is binding till this very day, even though there's no mikdash. Because avopi, she shomemimhem, even though it may be destroyed, bikdushatan hemodim, it still remains with Kedusha. And therefore, there are many, many halachot of Beit HaMikdash, the sanctity of Beit HaMikdash, that you're not allowed to use it as a shortcut, for example. Let's say I want to get from the Kotel area to Har HaZeitim, so instead of going around, you know, I just shoot over the Har HaBayit area and use it as a shortcut. You're not allowed to do that. Just like you're not allowed to use a shul as a shortcut. And if somebody does use it as a shortcut, he has to sit down and say a perek tillim in the shul so that he's not using the shul as a shortcut. And you're not allowed to deface Har HaBayit, you're not allowed to spit on Har HaBayit, you're not allowed to make it dirty, all kinds of halachot. You have to be be'ema v'ira, because you're standing in the presence of Shechina. And that Shechina is there till this very day. So that's a halacha. That's not an agadic idea. That's a halacha. that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is there. The Gemara says, "Me'olam lo zaza shchina me'adavei kotel ha-maravi." That's what is the Medrash. That a Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence never left the kotel ha-maravi. And that's why the kotel became so important to us, because it's identified as being the seat of the Shechina in the absence of the Kodesh Kodeshim. So if Kadosh Baruch Hu needs an address on Har HaBayit, it becomes the kotel ha-maravi. Because Kotel HaMaravi was adjacent to the Kodesh Kodeshim, which was on the west end of Har HaBayit. Why was it on the west? Because all the other religions faced east. That's why. Because they were worshipping the sun, and the sun would rise from the east. So therefore they were bowing down to the east. And we saw Kedusha entering at sunset. Vayerev Vayvoker. That's why the Kodesh Kodeshim is on the west. Because the moment of Kedusha is associated with the West. And that's why the Kabbalists of Tzvat went out to the fields on the Erev Leil Shabbat. Bo Netzei Likrat Shabbat Malketa. Where would they welcome in the sanctity of Shabbat? By going west. And that became the minhag. In our shuls, when we turn around for Boi V'Shalom Ateret Bala, it's symbolically leaving the shul. There's all machloket, whether you turn around to the door or you turn around west, right? And I love it when the whole shul does one way and two guys turn the other way. That shouldn't be done. That shouldn't be done. That's called lotit godudu. If the shul has a minhag one way, everybody should be a conformist and not stand out. A person should not really do something like that. But the general minhag wasn't so much the door. The door concept was symbolically to do what the Kabbalists of Tzvat did 400 years ago, was to walk out of the city limits to the field. But we're not doing that. So it's as if you take a step out of shul. Many times you have an important guest, you see this lahavdil at the White House, right? The important guest comes, you see the president comes outside and welcomes them. That's part of the covenant, you know, to welcome and to stand by the door and welcome the person in. So we go to the door and welcome in. Who are we welcoming? Welcome Kadosh Baruch Hu, coming into our homes for on Shabbat. So boi v'shalom ateret ba'ala lechadodi likrat kala penei Shabbat nekabla. You're going towards the kala penei Shabbat nekabla. Let me just digress for a second, because I think you might find this somewhat interesting. As many of the non-religious weddings today here in Eretz Yisrael, and let's just say that we are happy that the chuppah is being performed kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. They're not running to Cyprus and not banging on the door. At least most of the Israelis are not banging on the door for civil marriages. But most Israelis have enough sense of tradition that the wedding should be kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. It should be done properly. But when you say properly, there are many minhagim, many customs associated with the chuppah ceremony. So I usually sit down with the chatan v'kala once or twice before a wedding, and I work out what the ceremony is going to look like, because there are so many variables, and you want them to feel comfortable. I hate it when the chaz and kala are up there, and they're almost like non-participants. They don't know what's going on. There are plenty of weddings where chaz and kala, they don't have a clue what's going on. The rabbi just does what he does, and I'm going to give a ring, a red kodesh, the chayit, and the eidim, the vidik tuba. They don't know really what's happening. I think chatan v'kala should be into their own ceremony and should have a voice in saying which customs, and you offer them, you put on the table beforehand the various possibilities. I don't say that you have to go as far as one of my daughters, Chana, who made a comment that under the chuppah there's 50% chatan and 50% kala, so why is the ceremony 95% chatan and 5% kala, and therefore let's just work this out. Now she's a pure halachist, but she's willing to stretch the borders a little bit till the bitter end. And she wanted more women participation under the chuppah, as long as the halacha would tolerate it. Like having her chavruta read the ketubah under the chuppah. And Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein was there, Zichron Levracha, didn't say a word to me. Somebody told me, because he was a mensch, didn't say a word to me. But the fact is, we did things. Chosin makes a shechiyonu on a new talis. And my daughter says, one second, I just got a new ring, and I got a new refrigerator, and I got a new this, and that. I also should make a shechiyonu. You want to make a shechiyonu? Make a shechiyonu. There's nothing wrong with it. And it's just, nobody's thought of the fact that there's a kala there. But the worst thing is, the absolute worst, is if somebody speaks under the chuppah, like the Rav Masada Kedushin, and all he does is talks about the chosim. That happens usually if a Rosh Hashiva is the Masada Kedushin. He doesn't have a clue who the kala is. So sometimes he'll make a little bit of a passing comment at the end, and most probably the Kala is worthy of this great Chassan who I just talked about, right? Yeah. Most probably. Chazaka, you know, most probably. Maybe not, but most probably she's worth it, and so on. That's wrong. That's really dead wrong. First of all, the worst thing in the world to do is give the same chuppah speech night after night to different weddings. It's just like a mishaberach, plug in the ploini ben ploini, to change the names. Because that's called the Bal Tosif. That's called the Shablona, a mold of a bracha. We already have seven that everybody says the same thing. So if you make an eighth, that's Bal Tosif. Who needs it? If you're going to say a bracha under the chuppah, it has to be personalized. That never give the same thought twice for the same chuppah. You build it because you know the people, you talk about what they do, what their interests are of the young couple, and how to bring it to a message of togetherness and so on. If you have to give some thought. And it can be done. So let's close that window and let's go back. I knew this was going to happen. Where are you? Before I talked about the chuppah. But that was interesting, no?
That's where Mount Sinai is.
Right. Thank you, Mrs. Tech.
Sure.
So the Rav said that Har HaMoriah, we know exactly where it is. Har Sinai, we don't know where it is. And the Ramban says that it's the Mishkan that ultimately bridges both the territory and the time zone of the giving of the Torah to Yerushalayim. So therefore, if you just flip the page on the source number 10, Vaya Yeshayahu Perek Bet, Vaya Ba'acharit HaYamim, Nachon Yehar Beit Hashem Berosh HaHarim. That it's a vision of end of days, Achrit Yamim, where the mountain will be correct, Nachon will be properly in its place on the top of the mountain, and the nations of the world will flock to it. Not only Shlomo Melech in his great tefillah in Melachim Aleph Perek Chet invites the nations of the world to use the Beit HaMikdash as the focal point of tefillah. Like in America, there's a thing called the International House of Pancakes. But we have the International House of Prayer. And that's what Yeshayahu says, Ki beiti beit tefillah yikare l'chol ha'amim. So here too, Yeshayahu says, V'naharu elav kol ha'goyim, V'alchu amim rabim v'yamru, and nations of the world will proclaim, L'chu v'nale el ha'ashem, el beit elukei Yaakov, v'yoreu midrachav. So he, God, should teach us the ways, V'nelcha be'orchotav, we should go in his ways, Ki mitzion teitze Torah uvar Hashem Yerushalayim. Can you get a more famous pasuk than this? Ki mitzion teitze Torah uvar Hashem Yerushalayim. One second, wasn't the Torah given at Sinai? What do you mean, ki mitzion teitze Torah uvar Hashem Yerushalayim? So the Ramban understands this, that Yerushalayim is actually Sinai. It has moved. The location, the physical location, remained where it was, and we've lost contact with it because it's not important where Har Sinai is. What's important is what Har Sinai represented, and that moves on with Am Yisrael to Har Abaye, to Har HaMoriah. So now we can say, Ki mitzion teitze Torah, with Var Hashem Yerushalayim. I'll give just a mashal, an analogy. In Bavel, in the days of the Gemara, there were various yeshivot. There was the city of Sura, the yeshiva of Pumbedita, there was the yeshiva Nahardaa. In the Gaonic days of the Gaonim, the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century, the big yeshivot were Baghdad. So which yeshiva was it? It was the yeshiva of Pumbedita that at one point moved to Sura, and there was a different yeshiva there in Sura. So now in Sura, there's two yeshivas. The yeshiva of Sura, which was the yeshiva of the Amora Rav, and then there was the yeshiva of Shmuel, counterpart, colleague, and he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedita. But now it's located in the city of Sura. But it's the tradition of Pumbedita. Both of those yeshivot eventually make it to the city of Baghdad. So the city of Baghdad's yeshiva is not a new yeshiva, but it's the reconstituted yeshiva of Sura and Pumbedita, which was in Sura. No different than the Ponevich yeshiva, which was in Ponevich, the Mir yeshiva that was in Brooklyn, New York, and before that, Shanghai, and before that, Mir, right? Mir is in Belarus. We know exactly where it is. And the Kamenetz Yeshiva, and the Radin Yeshiva, and the Volozhin Yeshiva, all these yeshivas, The Rabban Kotla, Zecharon Lebracha, where was his yeshiva? Lakewood, New Jersey. No, but where was he from? Where was the yeshiva? Kletzk. So the yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey is called the yeshiva Kletzk. Nobody knows that because everybody calls it Lakewood. So now there's a koilil in Ramah, in Romema, it's called Lakewood East. So Lakewood in New Jersey has a koilil in Yerushalayim, it's called Lakewood East. Sadder. But so it assumes the name of the place, and now you go to various yeshivot, and there's a Chachmei Lublin yeshiva here in Eretz Yisrael, and so on. These are reconstituted with the names, because somebody was a descendant of some Rosh Yeshiva, somebody was a student of that yeshiva, and wanted to remember the yeshiva by having the name of the place memorialized. So too, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah V'Arashem Yerushalayim, so it's now in Yerushalayim, but in essence, it's that which took place at Har Sinai. And that's why it's a correct statement to say, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah V'Arashem Yerushalayim. Now, so I asked the question, I said, how is the Kedusha remaining forever if this Kedusha of Sinai ended, and because the Kedusha who left the place, so but the Kedusha who, as if to say, left the place at the Churban, the answer is no, he didn't leave the place. He never left the place, neither at the second Beit HaMikdash destruction, nor the first Beit HaMikdash destruction. And that, the Rambam says, is also a halacha. The sanctity of Yerushalayim is because Kadosh Baruch Hu never left the place. When does he arrive on the scene? When they build Beit HaMikdash and inaugurate it. But who invites HaKadosh Baruch Hu onto the scene is clearly human action. Am Yisrael. But one second, doesn't the Torah say at least 12 times in Parshat Re'eh, El HaMakom Masheh Yivchar Hashem L'Shaken Shmo Sham, the place, the location that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will choose. So here, we have a very, very, very important idea. Very important idea. If we're on that second side of the page, let's look at source number 8. Source number 8 says, it's a Dvarim Yudbet, it's Parshat Re'eh, and the Pasuk there says, L'shichno tidrishu uvat hashama. You shall seek out the place of Shechina, seek it out, where it should be, and that's where you shall come. The word doresh, dalid resh shin, as a root, means to inquire. V'darashta v'chakarta, in interrogating witnesses, the Torah calls it drisha v'chakira, means you interrogate, you try to find out. Tzionhi, doresh einla, says Yirmiyahu Navi. Yerushalayim sitting there, but nobody's inquiring about Yerushalayim. Which means Yerushalayim somehow got lost in the shuffle. And based on that pasuk, Rabbi Yehuda ben Zakkai, after the Churban, was worried that people are going to forget about Yerushalayim. So he institutes many, many halachot, zecher lemikdash. We do things, many things, zecher lemikdash, zecher liYerushalayim, so we should never forget. We took an oath, im eshkachech Yerushalayim, tishkach yimini. We took an oath, never to forget Yerushalayim. So we have to have concrete things there, put into place, that will guarantee we don't forget Yerushalayim. And the pasuk, the operative pasuk, is Tzioni, Yerushalayim sitting there, Doresh Einla, nobody's inquiring about Yerushalayim. So Gemara says, Michlal, seems that you have to be Doresh Yerushalayim, you have to seek out Yerushalayim, you have to inquire about Yerushalayim. Whenever I'm in Chutzlars, by the way, and I talk, I give a drasha on Shabbat, I begin by saying regards from Yerushalayim, Drishat Shalom, because it says, Shalu Shalom Yerushalayim. You're supposed to inquire about what's going on in Yerushalayim. I'm not talking about the weather. Whether or not there was snow, that's not what I'm talking about. You're talking about the Kedusha of Yerushalayim. And people have to be sensitive to this. So Rabban says, V'ta'am, and the reason, the Shechnot Hidushuam, in source number 8, She'telchu lo me'eretz merchakim, people who come from far places, V'tishalu, and they will ask, Ana derech Beit Hashem, where is the, how do we get to Beit Hashem? V'tamru ish el re'eyu, Lechu v'na'le el har Hashem el Beit Elokei Yisrael. The pasuk from Yeshayahu Perek Bet. Kilashon Tzion Yishalu. They will ask about Tzion. Derech Heina Pnehem. U'b'sifri, and in the Medrash it says Tidrashu Drosh Al Pi Navi. You should inquire where is the location to build Beit HaMikdash by the word of a Navi. Now that seems to contradict what I just said. If the Navi doesn't make these things up, the Navi is going to respond when he asks for a message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is calling the shots. It's not human action. So the Medrash says, Yachul tamtina chiyomalech ha-Navi, perhaps you should just wait around patiently until the Navi will call you and instruct you where to build Beit HaMikdash. No such thing. Talmud lomar, l'shichno tidrishu vatashama. Drosh u'matzah. You seek it out. You take those first steps. Launch the search. V'acharkach, and afterwards, while you're in the process of searching, yomar lecha Navi, the prophet, the Navi will tell you exactly where it is. V'chein ata motze b'David, says Ramban. And that's what happened to David HaMelech. David HaMelech is really the one who fulfills the pasuk, l'shichno tidrishu uvat hashama. It's not Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech builds the Beit HaMikdash. Shlomo HaMelech already had it on a silver platter where it was. That was already a done deal where it's going to be. The one who seeks it out is David HaMelech. And he's the one who inquires of Gad HaNavi where it is. And that's why, and the Rav explained this once in the Haftarah of Parshat Kedoshim, which comes from Sefer Amos, Perek Tet, source number 9, by Yomahu, Akim et sukat David Hanofelet. The Navi says, I will raise up, I will pick up, I will rebuild. Rebuild the sukkah of David. So the question is, you know, this is a famous harachamon that we say in Birkat HaMazon on Sukkos. And Shlomo Kalbach made a nice nig into it. Harachamanu yakim lanu sukkah David anofelet. It's straight out of this pasuk. Bayomahu akim et sukkah David anofelet. So why is it David? Shouldn't that be Shlomo? So the Rav said, because David, he was the one who actually located the place. Shlomo, before, in reality, built the Beit HaMikdash. David HaMelech very much wanted to build Beit HaMikdash, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw fit not to allow him to do it because his hands were soiled with blood. Now, the blood was Mechamet Mitzvah. Nevertheless, the very fact that he was a warrior somehow tarnished some aspect of David HaMelech's spiritual personality that did not allow him to be the builder of Beit HaMikdash. I remember in a great article that our Rebbe Rabbi Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha, published in 1981. It was first published in English and then he himself translated into Hebrew. And that was good because nobody understood his English anyway. So, and his Hebrew was also pretty tough and rough. But the article is called The Ideology of Hesder. 1981, Rav Aaron puts onto paper the theory of what Yeshivat Hesder is. It's not an accommodation between the defense ministry and the yeshivas. That's not a compromise. But he puts it as something very, very ideal. And you'd think that he was reacting to the Haredi world who feel that the boys should sit in the yeshiva and are exempt from the army. While certainly that message reads loud and clear in the article, The Ideology of Hesder, but it wasn't written for that purpose. It was actually written as a type of polemic against a very, very well-known Rosh Yeshiva of a very well-known Yeshivat Hesder, and I'm referring to Rav Goldwicht, Zichron Lebracha, who was Rosh Yeshiva of Kerem Yavne at the time. Kerem Yavne was the flagship of the Yeshivat Hesder movement, founded in 1954. It was the first Yeshivat Hesder. The only problem is, Rav Goldwicht personally came from the world of Ponovich, and he saw himself like a fellow who was a solid yeshiva bacha and a solid Talmud Chacham who should really be a Rosh Yeshiva somewhere, of a big time yeshiva, a Rosh Kollel, but unfortunately is teaching right now in afternoon Hebrew school at a conservative shul. That's how he saw himself to a certain degree, that this was not really a first rate yeshiva, and he would encourage his top Talmidim in the yeshiva to go on to learn in Mir and Ponovich and so on, and to leave Kerem Biavna. And there were many, many Talmidim who resented this, in Kerem Biavna, who resented this very, very much so, that the impression of Hesder was called Bidyevet. All right, if you can't hack it in a real yeshiva, so I'm glad we're doing this. And there was a policy coming from the top. Many of the Ramam of the yeshiva didn't believe that, didn't go along with that. They were from America's Rav Kook yeshiva and others, other Zionistic yeshiva. But it was a very Haredi orientation for someone who was Rosh Yeshiva of Kerem Biavna. And Rav Lichtenstein was asked if he can put something in paper that would allow the Talmidim to feel vindicated and justified why they're in Yeshivat Hesder, not just as a Bidyevid, but it's a Lechatchila. And that's what the article was. And he really goes to town with many of the arguments there. So... The the question of Sukkot David, I'll get back to this, the question of Sukkot David and not the Sukkot Shlomo. So there, in that article, the reason I bring this to your attention, he mentions that when he, before he came in Aliyah, Rav Lichtenstein, he consulted with someone who he also referred to as his Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Aaron's Rebbe was the Rav, his father-in-law. He was a Rav Muvak, and he and Rav Aaron was the Rav's Talmud Muvak. But nevertheless, he never lost touch with Rav Yitzhak Hutner Zatzal, who was Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin Yeshiva. And just as a note of biography, Rav Aaron was 12, 13 years old when he was in the Rosh Yeshiva Shir in Chaim Berlin. Yeah, okay. Not every 12, 13-year-old was sitting in Rav Hutner Shir in Chaim Berlin Yeshiva. And he developed a nickname in the yeshiva, which carried on to his days in YU. They called him Babes, because he was like the baby. He was the baby face, and he was the youngest. He was the Mazinka. He was really, 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 really the baby of the whole Chabura. Can you imagine? He's 14 years old, and he goes up to YU. He's 15. He's in the Rav Shir already. He's 18. He graduates college already. I mean, he was the Babes of the Chevra. That's all. Everybody was 4 years older than him. And in those years, you know, the difference between an 18-year-old and a 14-year-old is not marginal. But nevertheless, Rav Aaron writes that he consulted Rav Hutner about the whole concept of Hesder. And Rav Hutner told him categorically, there's absolutely no issue of Beitul Torah. No issue whatsoever when the fellows leave the Beit Midrash and go to the army base and prepare themselves to be active soldiers. No issue of Beitul Torah. Anybody thinks of Beitul Torah, it's categorically wrong. Wrong. But, he said, just be careful that while in military service, it somehow does something to your spiritual personality. Be careful, he said. Take steps to try to prevent as much erosion as possible. Spoke about erosion of one's spiritual personality. Because in the army life, things are very much not ruchnius. Very much. It's a very gashmius type of thing. I mean, the issues of life and death, and then fire and bullets and fighting. And I mean, it can bring out the worst of human beings. But, yeah, in Tzahal, they try to be very careful. And they're very aware of it. Very aware. That's why it is hardly in war, we've taken over territory, there hardly been episodes of booty, of robbery, certainly not rape, and this goes on and throughout the world, all over the place, and our Chayalim, Baruch Hashem, have the ability to control themselves. But it's interesting that where does the Torah say V'haya machanecha kadosh, and your camp should be holy? Doesn't say that if you're sitting in a shul in a Beit Midrash, because there it doesn't have to be said, but said in the army base. In the army base, Vayamachanecha Kadosh, Torah specifically says, be careful, be careful. That's why the Yeshivat Hesder, they would send out the Ramim, the teachers, and the Rabbanim to the base all the time to give them pep talks, you know, sichot, and have Dapei Kesher every week. I remember the Yeshivas to send out to the guys every week a page, you know, like a parsha page of sorts, what's new in the Yeshiva, just to keep Kesher, keep the connection. And it was called the Daf Kesher. I remember, you know, Rav Lichtenstein was very modern. He was clean shaven. He was in a gray suit and so on. But, you know, the younger Ramim all have beards and, you know, bigger yarmulkes and so on. Let's just say frum looking. So remember, Rav Aaron once drove, and he drove with two of his staff Ramim to visit the guys. And he gets to an army base. The Nebuch the Chayal at the gate, what's called the Shin Gimel. So he didn't know who these people are. So he said, they came to give shurims. He said, fine, the two Rabbanim can go in and the driver stays outside. So they explained to him who the driver was. The driver, that's a famous Gush story. Yeah. So what's the deal on how do we understand Sukkot David? So the Rabban asked the question that the Rambam, when he talks about the building of Beit HaMikdash, he speaks about it in the Mishnah Torah on two different occasions. And both occasions he uses different psukim, which is a little weird. And once he cites the pasuk in Parshat Truma, there it says, Vasu li mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. That's in Hilchot Beit HaBchira. In Hilchot Melachim, where the Rambam talks about the three mitzvot of entering into Eretz Yisrael, which was to appoint a king and to eradicate Amalek and to build Beit HaMikdash. So there it says, he brings a pasuk, L'shichno tidrushu v'atashama for Parshat Re'ei. So many of the commentators on the Rambam that ask, why is he inconsistent? Why is he bringing a different pasuk? And they give, either they don't give answers, they don't have a clue, or they give answers that are very unsatisfactory. And the Rav said, it's very simple, because there are two different mitzvot here. One mitzvah is to build a sanctuary, a mikdash, that's appropriate for sacrificial activity, for tefillah, for aliyah l'regel, that doesn't have to be Yerushalayim. That was the Mishkan in the Midbar. So each time they took it apart and put it back together like a, you know, building blocks or Legos, so they fulfilled the mitzvah of Yasu l'Mikdash. Again they built it, again they built it, again they built it, and they built it in the Mishkan and Shiloh. They built it the first time, Beit HaMikdash, second time, third time. That's Yasu l'Mikdash. But that Asu l'Mikdash does not have a specific location. Vayisu vayachanu, vayisu vayachanu, vayisu vayachanu. And over 40 times in the Midbar, they parked, they took apart the Mishkan, they put it back together, they fulfilled vayisu vayachanu, vayachanu. They put the Mishkan back together, they fulfilled the Asu l'Mikdash. But then there's the other pasuk in Parashat Re'eh, l'shichno tidrishu vatashama. And when we get to Yerushalayim, from here there's no longer movement. That's the second pasuk. So the Rav said, who built the Beit HaMikdash? Shlomo HaMelech. So that was Beit HaMikdash. But who gave the Beit HaBchira name to Beit HaMikdash? What's Beit HaBchira? The chosen house, the fulfillment, El HaMakom HaShe Yivchar HaShem L'Shaken Shmo Sham. That was David HaMelech. So David HaMelech, he's the one who locates the appropriate place for Beit HaBchira, and his son Shlomo builds the Beit HaMikdash. So David fulfilled the Shechnot Tidushu Vatashama, and his son Shlomo fulfilled the Pasuk, V'asuli Mikdash. But he wasn't the only one who fulfilled V'asuli Mikdash. So did Ezra and Nehemiah later on in history. So the idea is that David HaMelech is going to seek out where the place is, and then receive confirmation from the Navi that indeed he has hit the proper place. Look at source number 12, how the Malbim in Sefer Dvarim handles this. Kiyam al makom ashi yivchar Hashem, and so on, l'shechnot yirushu, bet kaf mem, bekol makom, in every place, kovei makom ha-mikdash, makom ashi yivchar Hashem. Wherever the Torah says makom ashi yivchar Hashem, it means the place of Beit HaMikdash. It was known, revealed by a Navi, by a prophet, that this was the chosen place. As it says, Gad el David. Gad el Navi comes to David. Nevertheless, we see that David seeks it out. As it says, Ad emtza makom lashem. Just hold your finger there and just glance back to source 11, the Perek Tilim Kuflam Ebet, underlined. Ad emtza makom lashem mishkinot lavir Yaakov. That David HaMelech in this Perek Tilim says that I would never sleep, I would never that, until I find the location. Right? Shir Malot, Zechor Hashem le David et kol unoto, Hashem nishba Hashem nadar lavi Yaakov, he swore to God, im avo ba'ol beiti, im e'aleh al eres Yitzuai, im eten shnat le'enai lafa paitma, I'll never go to sleep, I'll never close my eyes, I will never cease looking for the place, ad emtza makom Hashem, till I find and succeed in locating the place. So the Malbim says, you see the David HaMelech made a gallant search. Velohim tin atsheba ilav navi. I'm on the fourth line of source 12. And didn't wait until the prophet came. Velamad bima shekatub l'shechnot tidrishu, and derived from this pasuk in Parashat Re'eh, shehadrisha hi ma shechoker ba'atzmo limtzo at hadavar. The drisha, the search, is a human search. V'zeh shekatav drosh umotzei, Lamed lahem shelo yigalu Hashem sodo, that Kadosh Baruch Hu will not reveal the secret al yedei neviyav lo diyam makom anifchar rak im yishtadlu bazeh v'yidushu acharav. The only time a Kadosh Baruch Hu will send the Navi and confirm the location is after you've made the search by yourself. So what do you see from here? That what does it mean that Am Yisrael becomes geulim, as the Ramban says, the end of Sefer Shmot? They have the Mishkan, which is the prototype of the Beit HaMikdash, already in place. And something happens here that already Ramban says we're not going to have to wait 480 years till the first Beit HaMikdash will be built to call Am Yisrael Geulim. We can close the book on Parshat Pekudei, Sefer Shmot, because it already happens here. You know why it happens here in Sefer Shmot? Because it's precisely what the Malbim was describing takes place in Parshat Pekudei. So you don't have the Psukim in front of you, but I'm sure you remember from previous years by heart Parshat Pekudei, right? Everybody remembers Parshat Pekudei, right? He says, "Vateichel kol avodat mishkan oil moed vayasu bnei Yisrael kichol ashet tzivah Hashem et Moshe kein asu." They did everything. Vayaviu et mishkan, and this is vayakem and the krashim. They put up the krashim and so on. So Rashi has a beautiful, beautiful comment here. Shelo vayaviu et mishkan shelo ayu yicholim lahakimo. The boards were too heavy. Ulfi shelo asam Moshe shum malacha b'mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu really was inactive. He was passive in this whole process of getting all the materials together or bringing it together. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "All right, Moshe, now you're on the stage. We have all the material, all the raw materials here. You put it up. You're the builder." No human being was able to lift the krashim. The boards, they were too heavy. Moshe was the one who was able to do it. Amar Moshe lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, "Ech efshar hakamoto al yedei adam? How can a human being pick this up? We don't have a crane. We need a crane, but we don't have a crane." Amar lo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him, "Asok ata biyadecha." In our language, fake it. Put your hands on the board and make believe that you're picking it up. Nireh kimekimo. It's going to appear that you're lifting the boards. V'hu niskaf v'kam ne'ilav. But the boards are going to stand up on their own. V'zeh she'ne'emar, in the subsequent psukim, hu kam ha'mishkan. The mishkan stood up. So one second. Did it stand up by itself? Or vayakem et ha'mishkan? It says, and he put up the mishkan. The answer is both. Both. It was a partnership between human action and a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Had Moshe Rabbeinu not gone through this whole spiel of holding on to the krashim, nothing would have happened. Nothing would have happened. Kadosh Baruch Hu is not going to do the work for you. You have to show that you do the maximum what you can do. That's what brought the Medrash to say that the Yamsuf didn't split until Nachshon ben Aminadab jumped in. There had to be some human action in this whole procedure. Somebody has to jump in. I remember when one of my nieces, daughter of my sister from Hashmonaim, she was in Ramat Eshkol in the bank tfachot, where you get the mortgages, mashkantaot, for new apartments. And my parents would live there, and she bumped into my father, Olav Shalom, on the street there, in the shopping center, in the Merkaz. "Oh, Orit, how are you? What are you doing here?" "We just signed for a mashkanta right here in bank tfachot." "Wonderful, wonderful. Where are you building?" "In Har Bracha, overlooking Shechem." My father goes, "Dafke there, couldn't think of a better place." And so my niece said, "You know, with that," tells my father, her grandfather, "you know, with that kind of attitude, we never would have built up Eretz Yisrael in the first place." And she says, "You're right." You heard him say, like, "But why did it have to be you?" You think Har Bracha is not safe, right? Anybody want to tell me where exactly it's safe? Where exactly? New York City? Where is it safe? This is what 9/11 accomplished, by the way. There's no longer a safe zone in the world. No longer. We have to live with it, that's all. We have to live with it. We have to live with the fact that the world is not a safe place to live. So it actually inspires us to daven just a little bit better. And when you say the Birkot HaShachar in the morning, that you got up in the morning, not to take it for granted. Right, Baruch Hashem, got up, it's another day. And really to focus on what Hillel HaZaken said on the Pasuk, Baruch Hashem Yoim Yoim. Take every day for what it's worth, take it all in, enjoy your health, enjoy what you're doing, enjoy the nachas. And we should not live a depressed life, what's going to be in 5 minutes? But, you know, we have to take our precautions. And Baruch Hashem, or as my son Eitan would tell me, "Abba, this is not 1939. Am Yisrael is in a different place." Mm-hmm. You know, today I say this International Holocaust Memorial Day. So a fellow in shul this morning said, "Should we say a Perek Tehillim because it's..." I said, "We have our Yom HaShoah. We have a Sarah B'Tevet of Yom HaKadosh. The fact that the United Nations, they picked January 27th as an international... Let them observe what they want to observe. Should affect me in shul? I remember the Shoah every day. I don't need a Yom HaShoah. Every day you remember the Shoah. But my son is 100% right. 100% right. We didn't have F-15s and F-16s in 1939, and we didn't have Chayalim, and we didn't have. And if we would have had, it would have been a lot different. Am Yisrael would be in a different place. But Baruch Hashem, we have it here and so on. So we have to do what we have to do. We have to build Vayakim et HaMishkan, and Vayakim et HaBracha, and Vayakim et Kol Yishuv Yishuv, and hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is helping us Hukam HaMishkan at the same time. That's the policy. And then you feel Ge'ulim. That means you're redeemed. Because if you don't have that feeling, you are still a slave. You're still a slave to terror. You're a slave to the Americans. You're a slave to the Russians. You're a slave to the Iranians. You're a slave to the Hezbollah. You're a slave to the Hamas. We are not going to be slaves. We are going to be Bnei Chorin. Avadai heim velo avadim la'avadim. We're planning to be slaves to one, only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's where it begins and that's where it ends. And the loved one said at a Chubid Rasha, that he said a psychiatrist came over to him and says, "I don't understand." He says, I make a living trying to take all the fears that people have. You know, a person has he's neurotic about this, neurotic about that, and every fears this, fears that. And I try to help them through all kinds of therapy and medication to take the fear out. And here we come on Rosh Hashanah Kippur, we say, "V'chein ten pachtacha, Hashem Elokeinu al kol ma'asecha, ve'imatcha, ve'yirotcha." Give us fear, give us trembling. Rabbeinu Shalom, you know, this is what I'm trying to knock out of people. And the Rav said, looked at him straight in the face and said, "If you had eima, pacha, and yira for Kadosh Baruch Hu, you wouldn't have eima, pacha, and yira for anything else." That's what we're asking at Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's it. And that's the eima, pacha, and yira we should have. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu should make sure and guarantee that we should all be safe and happy and should be shalom by Yisrael. Okay.